Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Malacca is gearing up to head to the polls on the 20th of November. That means the election campaign has started now with 112 candidates contesting for 28 seats in the state assembly. And it's a crowded arena with many of the constituencies seeing three, four, five, up to six cornered fights. Now, today on the show, we're going to be taking a look at voting patterns in Malacca in the past and what that will tell us about the state's political dynamics at play for this state polls. Now, our guest tonight is Dr. Bridget Welsh. She's an honorary research associate of the University of Nottingham, Malaysia's Asia Research Institute. She's also a senior research associate at the Hufu Center for East Asia Democratic Studies and a senior associate fellow of the Habibie Center. Bridget, welcome to the show. It's good to have you joining us today.
Great to be here.
Okay, so we've heard analysts talk a lot about the Malacca polls and what to expect. And most of them point out that Malacca is, as a constituency, a microcosm of this country, or at least of West Malaysia. And then they say that these state elections could likely be a barometer or even a rehearsal for the 15th general elections. Now, I'm just wondering whether you agree with that. Is it really a microcosm of the country? And what is it that we should know about Malacca's demographics going into the state elections?
Well, I think the answer to that question is that it is and it isn't. It is in the sense that the demographics in terms of the ethnic composition, the kind of the rural-urban dynamics, as well as the kind of generational issues, do provide a kind of parameters that are similar to large parts of the country. But at the same time, it is a different type of contest. It is a special state of election. All resources are allocated there. It has a different type of attention. It doesn't have the same momentum of a general election campaign. So the stakes are seen as much lower. So therefore, you tend to have lower turnout in these circumstances. So I think that there are dynamics that make it unique. But from a demographic point of view, Malacca is quite interesting from a perspective of Peninsula Malaysia.
Bridget, if we could just sort of keep with that question about the kind of tropes that journalists use and analysts use to understand the political dynamics in the country. In terms of, say, the ethnic composition, do we see variations across the country, regardless of similarities in ethnic composition? By which I mean, are there other factors like political history or political culture? You know, is there a difference between, say, the people, you know, say, of Kelantan and the people of Malacca? You know, you see what I mean? How do we sort of assess that level of political dynamics?
Sharad, you're actually perfectly correct in the sense that what we have is a situation where every state has its own history, its own political dynamics. We know this and talk about them in the context of states like Sabah and Sarawak because they've often had state elections that are separate from the national picture. We talk about Terengganu and Kelantan and Kedah having a particular dynamic of being in the traditional Malay heartland. What we see in places like Malacca, in Negeri Sembilan and Johor, these are states that have traditionally been predominantly UMNO-driven states. They have a more conservative political culture. And Malacca as a state is a really interesting one in that large parts of the north look to the north, and then other parts of the state look to the south, to Johor. Right? So it actually has these kind of both looking north and south. In this context. And it is a small state in the sense that it's only about 500,000 voters. And people are, they still have the kind of traditional local type of dynamics and people know each other. There is a kind of strong sense of community. And of course, with that comes traditional strong sense of party loyalties. And as a consequence, one of the things that I look at when I assess Malacca Oaxaca is to look at traditional partisan loyalties in order to be able to understand the kind of dynamics that are unique to that particular state and what's happening on the ground. And I do think there is a particular kind of political culture. It's not as well known, but being from Malacca does have a different sense of identity. You have a sense of historical pride, a sense of kind of multi-ethnic interactions in terms of upbringing. It has a different identity. It's not a Johor. It is a Malacca.
Can I ask you on that note? Because yes, you're right. Malacca is very small, and it makes the politics hyper-local. Everyone seems to know everyone else. And I'm just wondering, does that, what consequences to that? Does that intensify loyalty and feelings of betrayal? You know, I'm just wondering who that benefits, the fact that Malacca has such localized, hyper-local politics.
Well, you know, a lot of states in Malaysia have hyperlocal politics, but in some places, those longstanding competition is in the family. It divides families in Kelantan and Terengganu, for example. You can really see, you know, oh, you voted for them, PAS or UMNO in that context. I think what we're seeing in Malacca is that we're seeing changes, and this the evolution of politics in terms of opposition politics has been happening over the last decade. So, for example, we see that Pakatan Harapan's support in 2004 was only 20%. It moved in terms of among Malays, for example, it moved to almost 30% by in the last decade, in the last G14 in 2018. So what we see is that the kind of the divisiveness, the polarization that exists in other parts of the system, the country, are not quite as strong in Malacca by point of comparison. But that doesn't mean that there aren't this sense of competition. And it's interesting, you know, one of the things that's happening in Malacca is that we have a lot of fragmentation. We have fragmentations within political parties. We have fragmentation within the political system as a whole. And there's tremendous competition. And this is what happens in a local community when you know that there are chances. People know that they're going to try their luck. And we can definitely see that happening on the ground.
Bridget, you know, people like to talk politics, right? And everybody's saying at this point in time, well, the DAP, they're going to win all the seats they contest, and that's a show win. And then the problem will always be for PKR and Amana. So in 2018, they stood for many more constituencies. They lost many more constituencies than they won, as I recall correctly. When we look at that, I mean, is this still a question of UMNO carrying the Malay vote or being central to that and then, you know, DAP being central to, you know, a Pakatan Harapan win? Has anything really shifted in those terms?
Well, if we look at partisan loyalties, right, and I've looked at partisan loyalties from 2004 all the way through the last general election, you know, the two strongest parties in the state in terms of deliverable of their share of the vote in their seats that they contest are UMNO and the DAP. UMNO wins on average of 54% of partisan loyalties over these last four elections, and DAP is not far behind at winning 51% in those seats. I think, you know, these two parties are the longest standing parties that have really had a political base in the state for decades. It's not something, you know, over the last decade. It's multiple decades. You know, keep in mind, DAP has been winning Kota Malacca for a long time in that area and had a particular base. So when these two parties go into an estate election, it's not a surprise that they will have an advantage in the places that they traditionally contest. And this, you know, some people would like to make this out as about ethnicity, but I think it's much more than that. It has to do with the way that the parties have developed their base and their relationships in these local areas, and they have grassroots. And as a consequence, this translates into a much stronger positions in terms of the state's the seats winning seats in the election. You know, even you know, this is a very competitive election. Almost 80% of the seats are competitive in some form, including DAP and AMNO seats. So I'm not one of those that would say that DAP is going to win all or AMNO is going to win all in their traditional base. I think the dynamics on the ground suggest otherwise. And I think it's important to realize that, to recognize how the parties have their own political history. You know, we were just talking about the role of political culture and the dynamics, but I think this is also rests on how the parties operate within those particular environments. And especially in this election, Sharad, because there isn't that much of a campaign, there aren't that many issues. So it's really gonna be about partisan loyalties to a certain degree.
And so, you know, just to follow up very quickly on that, the whole Barisan National split with Perikatan National, and in particular, the non-existence, as it were, of Muafakat National as a kind of AMNO pass coming together, consolidation of Malay votes. Do you see that as having a determining effect on the results?
I think it will. I think it's had the three corner fights affected 14, half of the seats in GE14. All right. And we can see that in terms of the numbers, particularly that PAS won, sometimes that advantaged Pakatan Harapan, sometimes it disadvantaged them, same for AMNO on the opposite side. We can see that at certain seats, it moves one way or the other. It's interesting that PN has actually positioned itself by trying to win ethnic support. So often there'll be two Malay candidates between AMNO and Amana, for example, or PKR, and that PN, for example, will slate someone who's of Indian descent or the opposite in the particular area to pull ethnic support. We saw this dynamic taking place in Sabah as well, right? The idea is to split some of the vote to win, not only through their own kind of their campaign tactics and their outreach. And PN comes into this election being the government of the day, predominantly, and also having resources at its disposal, which is more so resources than it had in GE14. So I think we're going to see an attempt to try to win in some areas, and the split factor will matter, but it will matter in some of the seats more than others, because I think what's interesting is that we do see different levels of partisan support across Malacca. And this comes from a number of factors. Number one, it comes from the problems within AMNO itself. So divisions have been a critical factor that's affected AMNO's political fortunes historically. We saw this in 2008, we saw this in 2013, we saw this in 2018, and we're going to see this in Malacca, because that you can see some of the candidates are on one part of the camp and some are on the others. And this is going to matter. I think the other thing that matters is the positioning of the different warlords within the party and how they work in building the campaign. You can see that some of them have less standing than they used to. And this, I think, is a broader change is taking place in Malaysia, where local warlords have really been challenged in their positions. And we can see that as a result of the competition that's happening in the political system.
Excellent points, Bridget. And we've got so much more to cover, but we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and continue this conversation in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned to Consider This, folks. We'll be right back. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutan. Let's continue our conversation about the dynamics at play for the Malacca elections. Dr. Bridget Welsh with the Asia Research Institute at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, is on the show. She's a longtime political observer of Malaysian politics. And we want to ask her, particularly, Bridget, if I may, take a look at the youth vote, which everyone wants to court. And I'm just wondering whether in this specific election state polls, whether the youth have been disenfranchised, because again, we know Undi 18 is not kicked in yet. And again, we're seeing the non-inclusion of Muda participating in these polls. What do you make about the youth dimension?
So I think, first of all, I think it's a real travesty and injustice in Malaysia that younger voters were not included in this particular state election. We can see from the EC's own electoral rolls, which were ready to go and to be placed and to observe and posted online, that there would have been 151,000 additional voters through automatic registration and through including those who were from 18 to 20. Most of those who were people within the ages of their 20s. So this election is being held in a way that really disenfranchises young people. And in the given Malacca's small number of voters, this would have been an additional third of the electorate. There was no guarantee that they would have all voted, but the fact is that they would have made a difference in these very tight contests that I think is looking to happening ahead. And I think that, you know, Malaysia does a disservice by taking away the rights of its young people, because the country is about the young people, its future. So I hope and I urge the EC to take more action, especially in the Sarawak polls. Now, when we look, for example, at the dynamics on the ground, we can see that the young people have featured in a lot of the candidates. So we see a student, for example, and young business people featuring among all of the major coalitions. And I do think this is a recognition among the political parties and the coalitions that they have to be able to reach out to young people. The problem is that this is a little too late, aka in the sense that, you know, many of these parties have been working heavily on focusing on things at the elite level. So there hasn't been that much outreach. So what we will see whether or not the slating of young candidates will make a difference. Now, MUDA's non-involvement, I think, you know, reflected, I think, my understanding, a rather complex series of negotiations within Pakatan Harapan and with Pakatan Harapan. I think there were also differences over the positions that people would have taken in terms of including different candidates or not. I think that, you know, MUDA as a movement is still a relatively young movement that has yet to have the kind of geographic base. And I think this is going to be something to see how it evolves for the opposition moving forward, what space MUDA as a movement can carve out for itself, and also what space and how the other parties are going to address the issues of young people. What is interesting so far is that they've slated young candidates, but they're not talking about the concerns of young people. And what is striking is that the debates on the ground, even though, of course, the campaign has just started, really do not address the concerns and the displacement of young people in terms of cost of living issues, unemployment, issues and changes in terms of impact of higher education, and so forth. And I'm interested to see how, in this last week of the campaign, how this will evolve.
Bridget, I mean, you are right about, you know, young people being the future of the country. Nevertheless, boomers and super boomers are clinging on for dear life. And I, you know, on that note, I'd like to ask you to address the question of the inclusion of the former Menteri Besar, UMNO Menteri Besar, as part of the Pakatan Harapan slate. Do you think this is a strategy that's going to work for Pakatan?
I believe you're speaking about Idris Harun, and I think he's a very controversial figure in Malacca. As you know, he contributed to a lot of the infighting and in the GE14 election. And so we have a situation where, you know, he continues to play a very lightning rod figure within UMNO. I think PKR's logic was that by helping to split UMNO, this would actually increase their chances politically, not just in the seat that Idris Harun was contesting, but more broadly in Malacca. I think that this is a strategic choice, which prioritizes, you know, wanting to win the state government as opposed to how it looks from the perspective of broader national politics, of which you're working with people who are seen to promote instability, but were also part of the system of the past that doesn't have a record of reform, and in fact, quite the opposite. And I think this is something that PKR and Pakatan Harapan were very divided about, and also will continue to have to wrestle with, because I think it helps to undermine the Pakatan Harapan's position in terms of a principal position position on reform, and it contributes to the cynicism that many people feel about what's happening in politics in Malaysia, and that they're all the same, and they're interested in trying to take power as opposed to standing up for sets of principles. And I think that it's very much short-term thinking as opposed to medium or long-term thinking in terms of this decision.
Right. Bridget, can we talk a little bit about, so we've talked about the politics, and I wanted to talk about the management of this elections, these polls, because again, the Election Commission, issued new SOPs about the way these elections will be conducted with campaigning and close proximity, close quarters gatherings not allowed. Can we talk a bit about, because you mentioned also there's not much campaigning to be had during this period for the Melaka polls. How do you see this shaping the results, the nature of the campaigning, voter sentiment, particularly in voter access to candidates and to what the candidates essentially stand for? And how that might, again, impact other elections in the future. We're looking particularly at Sarawak.
So it's pretty clear that the new SOPs disadvantage the opposition as opposed to the government, in that traditionally in the opposition's campaign, they've relied on building emotion, building campaign momentum, using things such as Charama as a pivotal thing to define their campaign. They are issue-based campaigns, right? They're not necessarily long grassroots party institutionalized campaigns. So I think this particularly disadvantages the opposition. And I think the second part about that is that the implementation of the SOPs has not yet been engendered the confidence one would expect that they have been equitably administered. So there haven't been good examples set about the way to carry out the SOPs. So therefore, people are pushing the envelopes. And of course, this creates a sense of imbalance. But I do think that more fundamentally, however, is the SOPs capture something that is happening in Malaysia, and that the nature of political campaigns are changing. They're changing where a lot of the decisions voters make are made in their own home through looking at their phones or on their computer or talking or checking out their WhatsApp groups or having that sort of simple conversation around families as opposed to engaging the politician. And they're looking for different sources of information. What is disappointment so far is that the parties have yet to use this kind of pressure to change their campaigning style, to escalate it and to elevate it into something where there is more open policy discussions, more debates, more engaging of different mediums among each other, more kind of interactive Facebook dialogues and others in some of the other SOP countries that had elections, even that of South Korea. So I think, you know, what we have are SOPs without the things that are moving up in terms of improving campaigning.
Yeah, Bridget, sorry, very quickly, because we're running out of time, unfortunately. I just want to ask you, there's a lot of anguish that the EC is beset by kind of institutional inertia or indifference to the current situation. And it's just not, you know, innovating. We see innovation around the world. And yet in Malaysia, there seems to be no interest. Is that your sense as well?
I think the leadership of the EC has not recognized that it's a different Malaysia and that they're expecting more standards and that there need to move towards more reforms, and they're holding it's holding the country back.
Right. Well, Bridget, thank you so much for chatting with us today. We appreciate your time. And as always, we could go on for another hour, but unfortunately, that wraps up this episode of Consider This. Thank you so much, Bridget. That was Bridget Walsh, political analyst from the Asia Research Institute at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. Don't forget to get the latest information on COVID-19 vaccines at astroawani.com as well as the Astro Awani app. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutton, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching the show. Good night.